Okay, we are in Parshas Vayishlach. Parshas Vayishlach has a number of different themes in it. The one that we're going to talk about, although we're going to talk about a very specific aspect of it, is in the beginning of the Parsha. The beginning of the Parsha tells us the story how Yaakov, as we read about last week, spent a number of years, 20 years, at his uncle Lavan's house, during which time he married his four wives, had 11 of his 12 children along while he was there, and then Hashem comes to him and says, it's time to go home, and he speaks to his wives, and that's indeed what he begins traveling back. As he's traveling back, he initiates a gift offering, which is where our parsha begins, to his brother Esav. If you remember, of course, Esav was the reason why he left in the first place. Esav wanted to kill him. Esav was quite hot under the collar over the fact that Yaakov had taken the blessings, the brachas, from him. And Yaakov spent a long time away, had hoped that the anger had cooled his relationship with his brother, and now he's on his way back. And so what he does, in the beginning of our parsha, he sends a lavish gift offering, and he puts it in the hands of his servants, and he sends them off, one at a time, so that every, whatever it is, 20, 30 minutes, another gift arrives at Esav's camp, and then another gift arrives at Esav's camp, and then another gift arrives at Esav's camp, and he sends a message saying that he's on his way back, and he'd like to come in peace, and everything should be good. And there's plenty what to study within the details of that episode, and I'm sure in future years we will spend time in that. What I'd like to discuss is the very end of that meeting, after they come together and they have their whole dialogue, when they go their separate ways, their final conversation between Yaakov and Esav that we have recorded in the Chumash is in this week's parasha, and those are the few verses that I'd like to focus in on for today. A word of background is the Ramban. The Ramban, Nachmanides, actually writes an introduction to this whole parasha, and he asks the question, why are we told so much detail about this meeting between Yaakov and Esav? Why is it necessary that we have this whole story here?
So we don't do it.
So, well, I think almost just the opposite. He actually says just the opposite. He says there are three lessons to be gleaned from the fact that the Torah tells us that we need to know about, and we're going to focus on one of those three. What are the three things that the Ramban says that we need to know? He says, the Ramban says, Nichtuva ha-parsha hazos, this parsha was written here. It's recorded for us, this whole episode. Number one, Lohodia ki hitzil HaKadosh Baruch Hu es avdo, that Hashem saved his servant Yaakov from a force that was stronger, more powerful, and greater than he, and that he was able to succeed in this mission. So number one, we need to know that, look, even though Yaakov approached, what was he, a family man with four wives and 11 children, and he's meeting up with Esav and his 400 well-trained soldiers, Yaakov managed to survive just fine. So you need to know that, number one. Number two, says the Ramban, Shehu lo batach b'tzidkaso, Yaakov did not rely on his righteousness, v'hishtadel b'hatzalo b'chol yichoto, and he attempted to spare and save himself with everything that was available to him. Yaakov did not say, God will help, I don't need to do anything, everything will be good. Yaakov went ahead, he created a whole system of what he planned on doing, and that's lesson number two, says the Ramban, that we need to take into account, that Yaakov did not sit idly by and let things happen, took matters into his own hand to try to save himself. And issue number three, says the Ramban, was the specifics of how he did it. The Ramban says, Ma'ase avos siman labanim, the stories that we are told, the episodes that are of us, our fathers experienced in Chumash, are a hint, so to speak, as to what we're going to experience throughout Jewish history. And we need to learn from the experiences that they had. And what did Yaakov do as he prepared for this battle with Esav? He did three things. He prepared for war. He divided up his camp and he said, how we're going to handle it. He sent a gift and he davened. Those are the three things that Yaakov does. We would call them, in our terminology, you know, having an army, preparing for battle. Diplomacy, that's what you always try first. He sent gifts, he tried to win him over, he tried to do some type of diplomatic solution. And then his spiritual efforts, he davens. Those are the three things that Yaakov does, and says the Ramban, and that's what we need to do. And then the Ramban adds, and that's how we specifically prepare for Esav. Esav, who is the 2,000-year Golos that we are in right now, which is called Golos Edom. There are four exiles that the Jewish people experience. Just drop a line, we're in Kislev already, so the Golos of Chanukah is the third of the four exiles, Gaul's Yavan, the Greek exile. The fourth exile happened with the destruction a couple hundred years after the Hanukkah story, with the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, and that sent us into the fourth of the four exiles, the Edom exile, which is the exile of Esav, or Rome, and that's the exile that we are still in today, even though we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, but that's the 2,000-year exile that we have been in. Says the Ramban, our dealings with Rome and with this exile that we are in right now, the way we know to manage ourselves is derived from this story as well. Diplomacy, war, and prayer are the three things that we do. With that introduction, it stands to reason that the very end of this episode, the last part of the interaction between Yaakov and Esav, should in some way shed some light on the stage of history that we're in, which is the very end of this particular exile. I'm not saying that definitively, I'm just saying it would stand to reason
if
if we use this story as a paradigm for how to handle ourselves in our dealings with Rome, it would be a nice place to turn to see if there's what to learn for the stage of history that we are in right now. So I'm not saying that like the sages, I'm just saying that it would just stand to reason, given what the sages have already told us, that it would make sense to look at the last little bit to see if it has anything to teach us about where we are right now.
Can I just clarify one thing? The first three, so the first would be the exile from Egypt? Because I know the destruction of the two temples represents second and third.
That's the Babylonian exile. No, it's from the first exile is from the destruction of the temple. The Babylonian exile,
yeah.
Madai, Persia, Greek, and then Edom.
Okay, so
talking post-entry into the land, four exiles from there.
Okay.
Okay, so what I want to study with you inside is on page 178 in your Chumash. Again, in future years we'll have time, we'll go through everything from the beginning of the Parsha until it's about halfway through the Parsha. So there's a lot to study within how Yaakov prepared, what the conversations went. He, of course, has his battle with the angel in which he comes out limping. There's plenty what to talk about. We're skipping. He actually meets up with Esav. Fast forward what we're up. They meet up together. They greet each other. Esav asks, who is this whole party that you're with? And my family. Yaakov says, please accept this gift. Esav says, I don't need your gift. Yaakov says, please, please, please. Esav says, fine, I'll take your gift. After that, we have where we are going to pick up. So if you look at verse Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph 11 on page 178. This is that last little bit that I just said. Yaakov says, please accept my gift which I was brought to you. Hashem has been so gracious to me. He doesn't want, he urges him, and Esav says, fine, I'll take your gift. Now we get to our section, five or six verses that we're going to learn together. Says Esav, Ayomer, Esav now says, Nisav v'nelecha, travel on and let us go, ve'elcha l'negdecha, and I will proceed alongside you. What does Esav now say at this point? They've met up together, they're coming from different directions. Yaakov's on his way back to the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, and they have this whole dialogue, which we're not going through into depth, and then Esav makes a request of him. What's his request?
I will proceed alongside you.
Let's go together. Let's travel together, me and you, together. Rashi points out the language of l'negdecha. Rashi says b'shavelach, equal to you. That even though Rashi's language is tova ze'eselach, I will do this favor for you, that I will delay myself to go as slow as you need. You're obviously here with a family man, four wives, 11 children, all this cattle. I'm here with the cavalry. I'm here alone with 400 men. We can obviously travel
faster,
far faster than you can, far quicker. But let's go together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I want to share with you are thoughts from a Rebbe of mine in Neri Yisrael, Rav Moshe Eisman, who wrote a wonderful little book on parenting. It's called Between of Parents and Penguins. I could tell you a little bit about why he chose that particular topic another time, but this is his introduction to his book. Some of the thoughts that I'm going to share with you today, just want to give credit where credit is due. If Esav makes this request, let's put this in historical context. We have been subject to untold atrocities throughout Jewish history, starting from the beginning of our exile as we settled into the Rhineland and France and Germany in the early thousands, beginning with the Crusades, and then from that point on. Our Jewish history is, where were we exiled, when, where were we slaughtered, and when. That's just the story of the Jewish people, with the major markings of the Crusades, the Inquisition, the Khmelnytsky uprising, the Holocaust. Those are the big ones, but everything in between is just, with a few bright spots, and most are just, it's been pretty bad. With our non-Jewish hosts in various areas. Even the places where we were originally accepted generally turned pretty bad. We've been exiled from just about every land at some point on the European continent. What would it mean historically if we were to interpret this episode in a historical context that Esav, at the end of this big battle that Yaakov has been preparing for, reaches out his hand and says, "Let's go together."
Okay.
What would that conjure up to you? In what historical era would you imagine this?
Maybe now.
So if you think about the stops that we've made along the way, where have we been the most accepted, welcomed? Everything has been accessible to us as far as professions and schoolings and places to live.
In Germany,
and then farther than that would be even where we are right now.
North America.
Not saying things are perfect here, and not saying when the Jews got to the shores of North America they were accepted at every law firm and medical school. They were not. I'm not claiming in any way that we were. We all know that many of the Jewish hospitals exist because we were not allowed. Many of the Jewish communities exist because we were not allowed to purchase land in other places. I believe Hampstead is one of those places that was not so long ago, right?
In the 1950s, you could not be moved in Hampstead, Kilburn Crescent. They didn't allow...
Not so long ago.
No, and also Hampstead School. My husband's family wanted to move to Hampstead, and Hampstead School would not accept Jews.
So
they did not move to Hampstead until Hampstead School accepted Jews. And also, like, a lot of streets did not accept Jews.
So, isn't that why men went into business? Because
very
they
often,
couldn't get into universities.
If you want to read a very fascinating little take on this, if you're familiar, there's an author, Malcolm Gladwell, has written a number of popular books. They're easy reads, but they're very informative and fascinating. I enjoy them. So in one of his books, he describes, it's called Outliers, is the book that he discusses, well, what makes people successful, a combination of lots of things. And one of them, he talks about how he uses the Jews as an example, how they couldn't get into this law firm, this practice, this medical school. So we created our own.
Exactly.
And we did it better than anything that we couldn't get into.
That's
how we've been.
Yeah.
And that's how we've been. It was out of the necessity of you can't do this. That. So again, without pretending that it's been like when we got to the States and Canada, everybody opened up their arms and said, we love Jews. Without pretending that that's a reality, the exile that we're in right now is a far cry from the shtetl in Europe and roaming bands of Cossacks and Crusaders and Inquisitors.
Just read today's headlines that Russia now is blaming the Jews for the murder of Nicholas and his wife.
Why not?
The opportunities that we have, the protection that we have, the governmental protection at the end of the day, is almost unparalleled in Jewish history. Despite all the difficulties that we still have, it's a welcoming melting pot that has overall been good to the Jews since we got here. And in fact, one can say it's been too good to the Jews since we've gotten here. I forgot who it was, who famously said in describing a Holocaust memorial in the last 20, 30 years, somebody said, we lost 6 million in Europe, and in the 50 years since we got to North America, another 6 million have been lost to assimilation. And on our own, we did as much of a job. The numbers that they quoted, again, I'm not quoting this, I don't remember, that the population in the U.S. since World War II had nearly doubled, and the Jewish population since World War II was flatlined, didn't move anywhere.
Except today you have Jews who are anti-Semites.
Okay, we're just talking about whether or not Jews, in terms of what we've lost as far as... So that melting pot of assimilation has had its own toll, a very heavy toll on the Jews of North America. And that, one can argue, as Rav Eisman wants to argue, Esav says, let's walk together. No longer a frontal attack of, I want to knock you off, I'm going to cause you trouble. Esav says, you know what? I so accept your gift offering. I see you want to make peace. Let's indeed make peace. Hand in hand, I will go according to your needs. Me and my men will walk alongside of you. And everything will be nice and beautiful. And we'll all get along and peace in the world. What is Yaakov's response to Esav's request of let's go together?
You just go ahead.
Let's continue. Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. Vayomer Eilav, Adoni Odeya ki hayiladim rakim vehatzon vehabakar alos alai. My master knows my children are tender. The cattle that I have, the sheep, is a burden upon me. Utfakum yom echad vamesu kol hatzon. If I push him even one day, all my sheep are going to die. It's so tender. My situation is such, I have to care for my young. I have this flock. I have sheep. I can't push him. I know you're going to slow down for me, but even one day, I can't even push him beyond what's going to be. It's going to be a devastating loss. Now, Yaakov is very careful with his words. He doesn't even want to mention something about his children, so he says, I have tender children and flock, and if I push him too hard, he only talks about what's going to happen to the flock. He doesn't even want to say the words, what's going to happen to my family. So he says, listen, Esav, it's so sweet of you, really, it's very kind. But, it's just
not
going to work for me. No thank you. No thank you. He then continues, Yavar Noa Aduni Lefnei Avdo, let my master continue forward before me. He uses a language which the sages discuss, is it appropriate or not appropriate? He continuously refers to Esav as his master and he himself as his servant. This was done as a sign of humility. We find this again when Yaakov is going to meet up with his son Yosef a couple weeks from now, after Yosef is eventually sold down to Egypt, to Mitzrayim, and Yaakov appears before him, when the brothers are talking about their father, they would continuously refer to him, to Yosef, as our father, your servant. And the sages there also talk about how that was inappropriate, that he allowed his own father to continuously be spoken to about him as his own servant. But here it's a sign of humility in which he says, you know, you're my master, I am your servant. V'ani esnahalali iti l'regel ha'melocha asher lefanoi u'l'regel ha'yiladim ad asher avo el adoni si'ira. Okay, long little pasuk here. Let's break this down. What does Yaakov now say in verse 14? So originally he said, listen, my children are tender. I have these nursing flocks and cattle. It's a burden upon me. I can't drive them too hard. So let my Lord go ahead of his servants, and I will make my way esnahalali iti at my slow pace according to the gate of the drove before me and the gate of the children, and eventually I'll meet up with you. I'll get there. You wait for me. Don't wait for me for supper. Take care of yourself. I'll get there. I'll get there eventually, but I just need to go at my own pace. And for the second time, he uses that idea of, why can't I go with you? I need to travel at a slower pace. Now, the language that he uses, what's fascinating. The language that he uses, what's instructive to us. Here we are, this is the final conversation that's going to be recorded between the two brothers. As far as we know, as far as it seems from the Torah, the two brothers will never see each other again. Esav is going to go off in his direction, Yaakov goes in, and then eventually a couple stories happen and he dies. We don't have any record that they see each other again. And Esav says, I want to go with you. I want to travel with you. Now, some of the sages see in that a reference back to the battle that they had in the womb of their mother when they were fighting. Some of the sages saw in that battle a battle over this world or the next world. And the net result, the sages say, we're going to get into a concept that needs much more conversation, I'm just going to skim the surface, that the conclusion that they reached inside, Yaakov says to Esav, you take this world, and I'm going to take the next world. They were fighting over it. He says, fine, you take it. This world will be yours. This world will be your place. I will forever be a visitor in your world. I will never feel at home here. I will always feel like a traveler. I will always feel like a guest in somebody else's home. But the next world, that's my place. I'll take eternity. And Asaph here says, let's go together. Let's split it even. Well, let's redo the deal. And we'll split it 50-50. I'll give you a place in this world, and you give me a place in the next world. We'll walk bishava, equal. And Yaakov says, no thanks. I'll take all the trials, the travails, the travesties, the Holocaust, the Inquisitions. I'll take it all in this world until we get to the final destination. But I'm keeping eternity. I'm keeping the next world, the world of the spiritual. I'm keeping that. But Asus is fine. What's Yaakov's response? How does he express that? He says, I can't keep up with you in this world. Asus, I'll slow down for you. I can't. How slow do I have to go? What's Yaakov's language? He says, "Es nahala li iti." That's the regal. I will set my pace, nahal li iti, laat, according to the pace of my flock and of my
children.
Now, Rav Eisman points out the word "es nahala" is the reflective description of setting a pace. It's reflective. It doesn't mean that I will set my pace. It means my pace will be set according to the needs of the kids. That's the language that he uses. I can't keep up with you, and I can't even tell you how it's going to go, because the pace that I'm going to go at, I'm not going to determine that pace. It's not up to me to say we're going to cover X amount of miles or kilometers per day. The pace that I'm going to go will be set according to the needs of my flock and of my children. If they need this, then that's what I'm going to do. And if they need that, they need a little bit more, they need a little bit less. The way that I will weather the storm of this world, a world in which I will never have a place, I will never feel rooted, it's not going to be my place, how will I weather that storm? I'm going to look at my kids and determine what needs they have, and that will be the pace that I will set. Asaph says, so I'll send some of my men with you. I'll leave, but let me at least accompany you with my men. To which Yaakov responds and says, Lama Zen, verse 16, Tazayin, and 15, I don't need that either. Emtzachein b'nei, let me find favor in your eyes, and let me go on my own, and they split. And in that phrase, Rav Eisman points out, is one of the keys to how we weather that storm. In a simple example, you know, I mentioned this in shul this past Shabbos, but like when you're dealing with little kids, children, grandchildren, whatever it may be, in school, it doesn't matter. We always, as adults, beat to a different drum than the needs of the kids. Because we're faster, we're quicker, we know what we're doing, we know how to buckle the car seat far quicker than they do, we know how to get their snowsuit on, we know how to tie their shoes, and from that, that's like in little kids, and every stage along the way, we know better. And there's a good reason for that. I know the teenagers think that we don't know anything, but we do. We know that we know.
Smarter as they get older.
Correct. As they get older, we get smarter. Exactly. Because we have the life experience, and we know how to do things. Yaakov says a fascinating thing here. He says, despite the fact that therefore the temptation would be to force the kids to keep pace with me, the parent, the adults, because these are my needs. I got to get to work. I got to set up this. I got to do that. Keep up. Let's go, we got to move. My pace is actually set by the needs of the children. I'm giving a very simple example of just getting out of the house with little kids, but it's obviously a paradigm for the spiritual needs of a generation. That it's up to the caretaking generation to be able to perceive what is the pace that's needed, what are the needs, and my pace will be set according to those needs. And in that way, we weather the storm of living in an environment that's not home. Whether it's the Cossacks and all the travails of Jewish history, or it's, let's walk together. whether it's the, come, let's hold hands. You could be part of whatever you want to be part of. We'll open up our doors and our gates. And again, I'm not saying it was always that way here on these shores, but in general it has been. It's the caretaking generation taking a look and seeing exactly what is necessary. He quotes that Rav Yitzchak Huttner, who was one of the great leading Rosh Yeshiva in America when they came over from Europe, of the yeshiva called Chaim Berlin, what a great educator. So he was once asked by a principal of a high school. He was asked this right before Rav Huttner passed away. He said, what should be the message that we convey to our students? When a student leaves the high school, if there was one message that we conveyed to them, that we hammered home, that every single one of our graduating students walks away with this idea, what should that message be? This is in the 60s and 70s in the U.S., which was a time period which I wasn't around for that. But what I hear was quite an interesting time period.
Yeah, they say that if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
That's right.
Yeah, so I was
talking about us.
I wasn't there for that. I was born towards the end of that period. So what should be the message? What should we convey to a Jewish student in a Jewish high school in the late 60s, in the early 70s? What should the message be?
Play basketball.
Never stop learning.
You know what the message, what he said? He said the phrase that we say when we begin davening every morning, Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim, that we were chosen from amongst all the nations. That they should have a sense of pride, of confidence, an understanding that we are a chosen people. And if the world around us wants to say melting pot or salad bowl or whatever they want to say, and integrate in
the cocktails
within that knowledge, always Asher bacharbanu mikol ha'amim. We have been chosen. We have a mission. We are different, and we have something to teach the world.
We're the light to the nation, right?
And we are. And that was a message that needed to be. And when Asa reaches out his hand and says, "Come, let's walk together." I needed to check out my children and see what pace do they need in order to be able to convey the message to them of their camp, of who they are. Yaakov and Esav go their separate ways. The Netziv, we've quoted before, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin in the late 1800s, 1890s, writes that Esav at this point gets the message. He says, Yaakov, you sent me all these gifts. You seem to want friendship and love and brotherly relationship, you really don't.
But not that much.
Because when I say, let me join you, you say, I can't. I say, let me send some of my men with you. Asaph gets the message. You send gifts, but you don't really care. You don't really want it.
In place of.
And you know what? That's also, we find that all the time. You know, it's like, there's like this, you know, I don't want there to be animosity, but I'm not really interested in a relationship. And that's what that's what Yaakov was looking to create. I don't want animosity. I don't want hatred. I don't want to fight you. I'll give you every gift of diplomacy that I can think of. I will pray. I'll be prepared for war. I hope it doesn't come to that. But you want to be besties? I'm not interested in that.
Was there not a midrash that said that Rebecca, when the babies were in her stomach, she knew that it was Yaakov that's going to be...
Well, the prophecy that she got was that the younger will eventually conquer the older. That the older will serve the younger. So when they came out in that order, she knew that. There's much discussion, did she ever tell Yitzchak that? Because Yitzchak seems to want, we know the whole episode with the bracha, which we're not going to get into now. Did he know that? Did he know that prophecy, that there was going to be two, that they were going to be separate, that one was going to be bigger than the other? Unclear. But in any case, and therefore Yaakov travels to a place called Sukkotah, and he builds himself a house and for his cattle. And then the story goes on. But we never see Yaakov and Esav again. This is the final discussion, as I mentioned. And interesting insights into the dialogue that they have and the way that Yaakov approaches it as to what's in front of us as we hopefully are in that final dialogue with the nations of the world in this Gullus called Edom that we are in, which again, as I said, the light's on the end. Half of the world Jewish population is already back in the land and waiting for the rest of us to show up. but a fascinating dialogue as we get to the last little bit here of their discussion. Okay, look forward to seeing you again all next week. Have yourselves